All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, December 14th, 2015, and this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everybody. If you can even believe it, we are spoiled here for one more day. On December 14th, it is 59 degrees. I'm partly sunny here in upstate New York. And I got to tell you, I just went outside and it sure feels like spring. It makes me want to go roll around in the grass and kick my feet in the air, but not for much longer because I'm just looking at the map and just a little bit off to the west. It looks like there's a large amount of moisture and there's lots of cold over there. So won't be for too much longer. So I might as well enjoy it while I'm at it. I actually had to turn the AC for a minute here. Because it was so toasty when I first came out here. So where did we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Banning Killer Robots, RoboCops, and Busted by Your Car, if you remember that. We had the car that tattletailed on its owner by calling 911 after a hit and run. And like I said, not that I'm advocating hit and runs, but it's just the concept of your car dialing 911 and blowing you in for something that you didn't know it was blowing you in for. And it's going to get more and more common as the Internet of Things closes down on us. And we have more and more biosensors that can determine not only, I mean, right now, I don't even know what they're using biosensors for. I don't know. We looked at all kinds of stuff. It's Monday morning. Give me a break. I'm still on cup number one, trying to recover here, trying to get my brain moving. But there's all kinds of biosensors that they can use. But like I was saying on Friday, just wait for the day when you swipe your cell phone and it's doing an analysis of any chemicals that are on your fingertips, you know, and then deciding whether or not to call the authorities. All right, so that's where we're going to start today. We're going to look at sensors, then we're going to get into some artificial intelligence and Internet of Things. There are a few really interesting stories this weekend that I had posted up. I got about nine stories queued up for today, and we know we'll never get there because it typically is only like four or five, if we're lucky. All right, so check this one out. This is out of Med Device Online. Tiny implantable chip could monitor blood and send the data to your smartphone. Now, we talked about that. This is the first one that I've seen that does like a direct connect. Nana's doctor is going to be able to keep track of her. She's going to have to upgrade, though, to the smartphone plan. A new wireless biosensor placed where? Oh, just under the skin. I can't even believe this stuff. Could offer weeks of continual blood analysis and communicate the results directly to a smartphone. If successfully developed, the device could take the place of invasive and inconvenient blood tests. Again, yes, those pesky little needles stabbing you in the ends of your fingers hurt so bad. I mean, I know, I hate going to the blood draw place, and I don't do that much anymore, but for a while there, they had me acting like a pin cushion. Probably, oh God, it was a lot of years that I spent a lot of time going and getting blood drawn. But it's not that painful. I mean, I guess if you're old and frail and trying to get out to the blood draw place once a week or once every 2 weeks would be kind of difficult. But I don't know if I'd be giving it up and getting a biosensor implanted under my skin. Hey, whatever happened to the sensor tattoos we talked about, right? All right, anyway, and they do have the tattoos off here into the margin. There's a story about those. If successfully developed, this device could take the place of inconvenient and invasive blood tests and offer doctors a what? Oh, real-time assessment of how a drug is performing in the bloodstream. The device was developed at the L'École Polytechnique Fédérale de Louisiane, wherever the hell that is. I would imagine France. And was presented this week at the International Symposium on Circuits and Systems in Lisbon. The device operates autonomously and can monitor your pH, temperature, and the level of metabolism-related molecules such as glucose, cholesterol, or prescription drugs. And measuring just 1 square centimeter, the silicon chip contains a circuit with 6 sensors, a control unit, and a radio transmission module. An external battery attached to the skin with a patch wirelessly powers the device through an induction coil, and the device can communicate with a smartphone through Bluetooth incorporated into the battery patch. During his presentation, Carrera, and that is the inventor of the device, reported that experiments on mouse models conducted at the Institute for Research in Biomedicine in Switzerland produced extremely promising results, and scientists were able to continually record the levels of glucose and paracetamol, which is acetaminophen, in the implanted mice whose daily activities were not hampered by any intrusive wire trackers. Well, Hugh, good thing we don't have wires hanging off us anymore. We can just have this little device implanted under our skin, and it talks via Bluetooth to our cell phone. It says everything our doctor ever wanted to know about us right there. This is marvelous. It says, because the preclinical testing was so successful and the device is minimally invasive, researchers believe that they could move the chip where? Oh, into human trials within the next 2 to 5 years. I'll bet you, we got to check. I haven't looked in a while, but we need to find out where that 21st Century Care Act is at in Congress. They had already passed it through. I thought it had gone through one of, whether it was the Senate or the House, I'm not sure, but I thought it had gone through one and it was sitting now in the other waiting for approval. But remember, 21st Century Care Act pretty much got the FDA out of the way. Not that the FDA ever was any large obstacle to begin with, but it pretty much got the FDA out of the way. It loosened any type of R&D requirements. And it now pretty much makes it a full-blown free-for-all for any mad science gun, man. We can test it in humans, find someone really desperate and dying with some horrible disease who would kill to have this technological advance to try and save them. And then once we get it into a few of those people, we'll write up case studies. And the case studies will be our proof that it works. And I mean, like I said before, that's how they do it in the tech world. So it's pretty interesting as technology is merging with medicine here. Now they are deciding not to give two shits about your well-being or mine. You know what? Prey on the dead and dying, and let's write some case studies and start making sales, because that's what it's all about. All right, so this is only the latest in a virtual tidal wave of portable medical monitoring devices introduced in recent years. You know, I was just reading a story. I don't remember what manufacturer it was, but we had talked about the smartwatches, and, I mean, that's really where all the biosensing kind of started, was being able to track your steps or being able to tell what your blood pressure rate is or whatever. Well, some story out last week that was talking about one of the major ones, and of course it wasn't Apple because Apple's already into this, or Google, but it was one of the big names that was making just like the Fitbits or whatever, and they have decided that they are moving full-blown into the medical tracking space, and that really seems to be the new Gartner quadrant. You know, that business publication they put out every year as to where the sales and the money is going to be, especially in the tech industry. And it looks like that's where everyone's decided that it's going to be. And of course, precision medicine, the bioeconomy, those are things inked by the White House that are being rolled out, not just nationally, but internationally. It's all over. The stuff is happening all over, and it is really a takeover by the medical establishment. Down to the cellular level to make you a part of the Internet of Things. And that's what we'll look at here later, which we've looked at that before. But so not that it's a surprise, but Monday mornings, it disturbs me. I don't know. I'm still trying to drink my coffee. It was a rough one. I worked a lot this weekend. I was really busy. And I managed to see an old friend I hadn't seen in a few years. We've known each other for a really long time. So that was fun. But it took a big chunk out of my afternoon. And it was quite a drive, too, to go. But it was a good time. It's a good time. But now I feel like a day off. Since I don't ever get one. All right, let's finish the story. Anthony Turner, professor and research scientist at WHERO. It's good old Linkoping University again. We talked about them on Friday. Linkoping recently presented at the 4th International Conference on Biosensing Technology and introduced a credit card size sensor capable of analyzing blood and saliva samples. Says we are on the cusp of an entirely new era, not just for biosensing, but for measurements in healthcare and diagnostics. Until now, we've been used to going to the doctor, who endows us with some wisdom and retains information about us and then waits to see if we get better. Modern sensors and telecommunications are rebalancing this power. And in the future, patients could have the information while physicians provide the service. How scary. Modern sensors and telecommunications. If you asked me when I spent my last 20 years of a career in, I would tell you telecommunications. Telecommunications and data, but it's all pretty much the same thing. And it's the transfer of data across a medium from point A to point B and then doing something with it. And that's what I've spent my entire adult career doing. And here it has morphed into this dystopia. I just don't like this. And, you know, he says we're moving into this entirely new era of biosensing. Well, if we start thinking about the levels that they are doing this at already, I mean, we know how much information that they have. We know we can guess with what they're going to be able to do about it. But what happens when your decisions, your personal decisions, are no longer yours? I mean, I know most of us don't like to be told what to do. And especially anyone who's a smoker, or anyone who's a little bit overweight, or anyone who's ever had a cholesterol issue or high blood pressure. And you've either had your doctor or your spouse or your girlfriend or boyfriends or mother, cousin go, Johnny, you know, you shouldn't be smoking anyway. You should quit. You know, and the second you get somebody like trying to tell you who's managed to get along for 40 some odd years of your life just fine, that that other person instructing you as to what they think is right for you. You know, how's this going to turn out here? Because I, honestly, that whole resistant consumer thing, I mean, unless, of course, they tell you that by taking this implant, by following their directions, you're going to get younger and you're going to live forever and we can cure your cancer, which I really think. Remember, dangling carrots. There's always got to be a dangling carrot to get the rat to run into the trap. A big dollop of peanut butter. Yum, yum. Don't fall for it. All right. I don't know. There's like 12 sensors down the side here that, I mean, we literally could go through and read all these different things that they're already able to do, but I want to get on to other things. It's already 15 minutes into the show. All right, so there's another one. This is out of the same publication. Sweat sensors could bring medical diagnostics to wearables. And maybe this is the story I was talking about. So, you know, there's a lot of wearables out there, and they're rolling out a lot more, right? We have all this wearable computing that we've read about now, even Levi's, and I believe it was Google, had some sort of collaboration going where they were going to start weaving wearable computing into the material so then they could make things with it. Remember, once it becomes wearable, it becomes ubiquitous. It'll be everywhere. We read a story back on Friday or Thursday, Mamie, that it talked about the death of the cell phone within the next 5 years. We're like, 5 years? Where's the cell phone going to go? And then we dig into the story, and it's like, oh, well, the cell phone's not going everywhere. It's just going to get integrated into everything. Yes, our clothing, our houses. It'll be smart, everything. Your smart car, you know, and here's the thing. Once your car is a smart car and they put some sort of 24/7 connectivity on it. I mean, they had that already before with the GM. I don't remember what it was called. Oh, I don't even have chat up. Everything crashed on me. Whatever that GM product was called. I mean, it's probably been around since 2008 or so, where if you lock your keys out, or even maybe even before that, you lock your keys out or you lose your car, you can call GM and they got some sort of satellite thing in the cars that go boop, 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 boop. Oh, yeah, we found it. Let's unlock the doors and we'll help you out there, Johnny. But you got to figure, once the cars are all beyond smart, like now we're talking graduate level car, they'll probably have some sort of location device, whether it be GPS, I don't know if it would be some sort of cellular transmitter, but they might even be able to make you like a Wi-Fi hotspot at some point. Wouldn't that be cool? And think about it, like when you go somewhere and you end up with no internet, or your cell phone's really sucky slow and it's so tiny trying to use one of those browsers and you need to find something, wouldn't it be awesome if you could use your car as like a Wi-Fi hotspot as it's pulling off of your cellular connection? I mean, I think it might be okay with something like that, but not with my car. And we saw this on Friday, the car blowing you in. I am not okay with my car. In this case, it dialed 911 because it believed she had had an accident. She didn't respond. She had actually set it up so if she was unconscious, quote unquote, it would call and report her. But I have heard from acquaintances and friends of mine that they have company cars that have way more than that. And with the black boxes, they could track your speed. They're going to be sending information back to the insurance companies and to your employer. I mean, for years, they've had the GPS tracking on fleet vehicles. You know, whether it be like a repair van for, you know, a company that does, you know, end user or corporate repairs, you know, like the cable company or some sort of telecommunication provider. I mean, like, that's the type of things that I dealt with. When the circuits are out, when the router goes down, typically you roll a truck, but they want to make sure that Joe Bob Repairman isn't running off to, you know, get some lunch or do his Christmas shopping while he's supposed to be fixing your router. So anyway, they've been doing that for a long time, tracking fleet vehicles, but it's gotten way more than that. I mean, they can track your speed on the highway 24/7. They can get a record, no speeding. Remember, future of self-driving cars, once you speed, the car is going to take over for you. Yes, we're sensing a little bit of road rage, and you are now an insurance hazard. We are going to take over from you, and we'll return control of the vehicle once you have calmed down. Anyway, sensors could bring medical diagnostics to wearable sweat sensors. Sorry, wearable technology, like that seen in the fitness space, is making a transition to medical diagnostics. So we had like the kickoff to getting people used to wearables was marketing it to the health nuts. And the health nuts loved it. And not, not that there's anything wrong with being a health nut. You know, being healthy and exercising, anyone who hasn't been there in a while, I've been there within the last few years, and I did. I got super healthy. I lost like 20 years. I went, set the clock back. And I'll tell you what, it's addictive. I was reading about it, and the reason why it's addictive, guess what it produces? Many other chemicals. But one of the things that exercise produces in the brain is dopamine. Ding, 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 ding. Yes, good old dopamine addiction. I love my dopamine. You need to use it for good, not for bad. And don't become the rat in the trap, because they use that as a dangling carrot. But anyway, so they took all of these fitness fanatics who wanted to be able to give themselves real-time data on how much better their exercise was from today to yesterday. And they rolled out these sensors as something wonderful for these people. Well, now that they've done all their testing, and now that they are ubiquitous in the market, they are now going to make a transition because they see where it's going. Now it's all about the medical establishment. It says, by analyzing sweat, and this was something that back a few days ago I had postulated would be really easy to do. You know, your sweat, your breath. I mean, there are all kinds of indicators now that they can get from non-invasive samples. You know, it's no longer necessarily a finger prick. Well, this one happens to be just sweat on your skin. By analyzing sweat, a new patch can identify cystic fibrosis and may one day be used for monitoring blood glucose levels. Now, cystic fibrosis right now, the only way that I know to diagnose that is to get a DNA test. They actually made me get that when I was pregnant. They made me get that test. I think they probably do that for everybody. And the reason for that is if there is only one parent that has the cystic fibrosis gene, then the child will not get it. But if both parents have a cystic fibrosis gene, then there's a really good chance. And cystic fibrosis, if you ever looked it up, I mean, I haven't looked a lot in detail, but I know it's a lung disease that makes it very difficult to breathe. Lots and lots of phlegm. And the child with cystic fibrosis typically doesn't live too far into adulthood. I always thought it was like with cysts, but no, it's a thickening of the lining of the lungs with this phlegm. But anyway, so I don't know what the patch identifying cystic fibrosis is going to do. I mean, they DNA test that anyway. But all right, let's get back to the story. So what if we could substitute a sampling of sweat for a blood sample? Hey, good idea. Many would find that preferable to having blood drawn with a needle. It may now be possible, and we don't often think of sweat as bodily fluid useful for analyzing what is going on in our bodies. However, sweat contains a significant amount of information about metabolic activities that are happening within our bodies, and it is essentially available in real time. A new patch-type technology is being developed by researchers at the University of Cincinnati and is placed on the subject's skin. The device consists of a multi-layer structure which is designed to draw fluid from the skin of a patient and deliver it to a flex circuit sensor contained in the patch. An antenna then delivers the data to your smartphone, that good old smartphone, where it then can be analyzed. And after analysis, it can be provided information on the patient's sweat to your doctor. Sweat contains electrolytes. And as most of us have heard from various sports drink advertisements, how the body deals with electrolytes. It was weird, big pounding outside, can be revealed in your sweat. I don't know. Do we really want to keep reading this? So they can detect cystic fibrosis. Like I said, I don't, I mean, maybe people still got got away with never having a diagnosis and had a mild case, but I know that they DNA, I mean, up until 10 years back, they were already DNA testing for that before birth at very early stages of the pregnancy. Another possibility for this device is analyzing the levels of lactic acid in sweat, correlating to the blood glucose levels. Lactate is a byproduct of burning glucose without oxygen, a condition that often occurs with diabetics as they approach a critical insulin situation. Rapid patch technology is gaining momentum in the medical device research arena as the need for rapid diagnostics is realized. And we even saw DARPA was working on some stuff for bioterror agents. I mean, I thought, honestly, I had read stories back not too long after September 11th, 2001, that they had already had mobile biosensors up on telephone poles and slapped all around New York City to be able to be the first line of a defense for a potential bioterror attack. All right, one more story here. This is one I posted on my own page back about a week ago, titled, and this just caught me by surprise because it's kind of frightening. Engineers build a biologically powered chip. Yes, they have. Columbia engineering researchers have, for the very first time, harnessed the molecular machinery of living systems to power an integrated circuit from adenosine triphosphate, which is your ATP, the energy currency in all cells of life. They achieve this by integrating a conventional solid-state contemporary metal oxide semiconductor, which we all know is CMOS, integrated circuit with an artificial lipid bilayer membrane containing ATP-powered ion pumps, opening the door to creating entirely new artificial systems that contain both biological and solid-state components. Now, why would we look at this as important? Well, how about this is one of the very first crossovers, and I mean, we've seen a few brain implants on live National Geographic TV, but I mean, this is a little bit different. This is finding a way to make an itty bitty little processor out of something that's biological and using biological, I don't even know, what is ATP? Is it a protein? Whatever it is, using something within the body to power the microcontroller. That's pretty frightening. And I thought we had heard, read in an interview somewhere, and I thought it was with Eric Drexler, the father of nanotechnology, as one of the rules of merging man and machine, you never, and I thought that was like one of the big rules, you never use biological components as a food source for your machines, right? Because, hey, all it's going to take is one little thing going awry. You know, how many computer problems do you have on a weekly basis? Never. Oh, my God. They work perfectly 100% all the time. No, they don't. Just like some tiny little transhumanist hybrid biologically powered chip inside your body probably is not going to work 100% all of the time. I'd be a little wary of this. Anyway, we'll read a little bit more. This gets really technical, so I don't know, it's too early on Monday for that for me. It says the study led by Ken Shepard, Lau family professor of electrical engineering and professor of biomedical engineering at Columbia Engineering, was published in Nature Communications. In combining a biological electronic device with CMOS, we were able to create new systems not possible with either technology alone. And we are excited at the prospect of expanding the palette of active devices that will have new functions such as harvesting energy from ATP, as was done here, or recognizing specific molecules, giving chips the potential to what? Oh, taste and smell. And that was something that I had a couple stories queued up a few weeks back about them already integrating taste and smell into electronics. So this gets even better because this is like a full hybrid device that can do that. I mean, it's like a total combination of biological and electronic that then they're giving two of the five senses. It's very scary. Says this was quite a unique direction for us, and it has great potential to give us solid state systems new capabilities with biological components. Oh, let's jump up and down, clap our hands, and be so excited about this. I mean, that's give solid state systems new capabilities with biological components. In living systems, energy is stored in potentials across lipid membranes, and in this case, created through the action of ion pumps, ATP is used to transport energy from where it is generated to where it is consumed in the cell. And to build a prototype of their hybrid system, Shepard's team packaged a CMOS integrated circuit with an ATP harvesting biocell, I guess they're calling them. And in the presence of ATP, the systems pumped ions across the membrane, producing an electrical potential harvested by the integrated circuit. While other groups have harvested energy from living systems, Shepard and his team are exploring how to do this at a molecular level, isolating just the desired function and interfacing this with electronics. We don't need the whole cell, he says. Nah, we just grab the component of the cell that's doing what we want. For this project, we isolated the ATPases because they were the proteins that allowed us to extract energy from ATP. Guys, you're going to become a natural resource. Oh, we need more energy? Hey, guess what? We got rid of all the coal plants and all these other dirty plants under the COP21 agreement that we inked last weekend. But you know what? Green energy that's formed in your cells will save the planet. So just step right up and let us harvest some of that ATP to keep the city running. I mean, this is really frightening. When there are biological components that are produced within your body that can be used as a fuel source, you've now become ripe for mining. Just like the asteroids. I just saw again, they're talking now there's going to be this big, like, mining jump. And they've been talking about this for a while after we landed on an asteroid last year or the year before. But I guess that's going to be the new frontier in mining. And it's going to be like a new, brand new gold rush. Well, so will it be harvesting proteins. And as you know, as they start to understand more and more about what an amazing mechanism your body is down to a DNA level, and they learn how all these bits and pieces work, and they start integrating all this biological with the digital, they start making the digital Jabba the Hutt. DNA storage, right? They've already been messing with that for storing data on a DNA strand. That, I mean, it was some insanity too. Half a pound of DNA could store every movement or sound or anything ever that ever happened at any point in time ever in history on like a half a pound of DNA. The ability to build a system that combines the power of solid-state electronics with the capabilities of biological components has great promise. You need a bomb-sniffing dog now, but if you take just the part of the dog that is useful, ding, 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 which are the molecules that do the sensing, then we wouldn't need the whole animal. Oh, my God. That sentence is going to haunt me. This is not just the dog. It's everything. We are going to all be replaceable. They'll farm us. You know, we got to get rid of the cows because they produce too much methane. Holy crap, that dog next door just scared the crap out of me as we're talking about dogs not being necessary. With the appropriate scaling, this technology could provide a power source for implanted systems in ATP-rich environments, such as inside living cells. So they're going to make you a little biological power factory. You know, one of my friends years ago had postulated that at some point, for us to exist here on planet Earth, they were going to make us pay back in energy. Well, and he was just postulating kinetic energy, but this is even scarier, ATP, cellular energy. But he was postulating that they would make us pay back energy to the system to be able to utilize it. Because right now we're freeloaders. We pay cash, but cash really isn't anything. Energy. Energy is where it's at. All right, now let's start getting into some more of this artificial intelligence. We talked about Toyota last week or the week before dumping $1 billion into a new AI research facility in California. They have one of the directors of DARPA that's going to be taking over to manage the whole facility. So how amazing is that? Well, check this out. Toyota harbors big ambitions for a partner robot business. Toyota Motor Corporation is harboring big ambitions to become a significant player in the growing market for robots that help the elderly and other people get around in daily life. Now, we were just reading about Samsung in South Korea working on a lot of this same technology. So it looks like now it's going to be the battle of the Korean and Japanese electronics makers for getting in to build robots to help Nana. All right. The company believes that it can use its manufacturing expertise to become as crucial in a field that it calls partner robots as it is to automaking. And robotics engineering at Toyota is currently numbering only about 150 out of a worldwide staff of 300,000, but it is plowing money, plowing. I wonder if plowing is equivalent to $1 billion. Plowing money into research and development. And here it mentions the story we read. Toyota last month announced a $1 billion investment in a research company headed by robotics expert Gil Pratt of Silicon Valley. And I believe Gil Pratt was the one that just came from DARPA. It is already working with Stanford University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on robotics. He says, we are preparing for a future in which people may not be able to drive cars. Oh, really? Yes, or they don't allow us to. Or they may need artificial intelligence to support them to drive. And once they get off their cars, they may need then help from partner robots. The Japanese government is banking on robotics as a growth industry in a society that's aging at a faster pace than any other industrialized nation. And we've talked about that before. Yes, Japan is statistically becoming older. And I don't know what the numbers were, but we had looked at it one time. And they are not. Their birth rate is tanked. And gee, I wonder why. It has nothing to do with all the radiation all over, I'm sure. Anyway, other companies have jumped in, including the internet company SoftBank, which sells humanoids that carry on simple conversations. And in Japan, actually, they are so far beyond us with Android-like robots. Speaking to the Associated Press at the Tokyo Robotics Show this week, Toyota's robotics interest goes back decades, including their use in manufacturing at its auto plants, but now it sees the technology as a viable business in its own right. Some of the impetus comes from the focus of auto and tech industries on using artificial intelligence to develop cars that can drive autonomously. Google, of course, is trialing its driverless car. And Toyota's Japanese rival, Nissan, I haven't heard about the Nissans, is especially confident about the technology, which plans to start selling vehicles by 2020. Honda Motor Corp was a leader in robots with its ASIMO. Yes, we talked about good old ASIMO. Walking and talking child-shaped robot, which has been in development for over two decades. Critics say that they don't like ASIMO because they got sidetracked focusing too much on duplicating human movements. Toyota demonstrated a one-armed partner robot on wheels. Oh, no. Probably looks like some sort of gambling device. Toyota demonstrated a one-armed partner robot on wheels loaded with sensors and cameras earlier this year. The R2-D2 lookalike, known as HSR, or the Human Support Robot, can pick up people and bring an item to a bedside or open the curtains. And among developments in the works is a second arm for this robot, which will allow it to perform more complex tasks and adding conversational skills. So there you go. Toyota, I mean, $1 billion in artificial intelligence. And then on top of all that, dumping another huge gazillion dollars into robotics development. And that's just one of many companies. All right, another story. Wow, this is a long Monday. Scientists teach machines to learn like humans. Team of scientists has developed an algorithm, ding, ding, that captures our learning abilities, enabling computers to recognize and draw simple visual concepts that are mostly indistinguishable from those created by humans. Now, this is leading up to where I've been trying to get back to for 2 weeks about the day when robots take all of our jobs. Now, as they are imbuing artificial intelligence across all these different devices, they've already predicted within the next few years it's going to be so amazingly disruptive to the economy and to the ability to find a job, because it's all going to be outsourced to the AI and to the software. And hey, even better than that, I've been talking forever about software as a service. Everything is being done in the cloud now. I was having conversations yesterday with one of my old friends about some of the stuff that's actually going on in the cloud. And I mean, I can't even talk about some of the stuff that's, it's pretty insane, guys. It is coming faster than you and I know. And we better be prepared. Team scientists has developed an algorithm that captures our learning abilities, enabling computers to recognize and draw simple visual concepts that are mostly indistinguishable from those created by humans. The work, which appears in the latest issue of the Journal of Science, marks a significant advance in the field, one that dramatically shortens the time it takes for computers to, quote-unquote, learn new concepts and broadens their applications to more creative tasks. Now, of course, when asking some of the big moguls what's going to happen when the robots take our jobs, and they say, don't worry about it, the robots won't take all the creative jobs. We still need humans to do all the creative stuff, the stuff that requires thinking. Well, remember, this is all exponential technology. So all of these huge advances that we just experienced last week, well, in another couple months, it's going to be flipped three times, 3 to the 10 on its head. I don't know. Pick a number, some huge number on its head. It's exponential. So once you have a genius supercomputer now trying to solve the next big problem of humanity and recreate itself again, you're going to have a much smarter computer that's working on the next problem. So this isn't going to take 30 years. It's not. It says our results show that by reverse engineering how people think about a problem, we can develop better algorithms. Moreover, this work points to a promising method to narrow the gap for other machine learning tasks. The paper's author, who's an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Toronto and another one at MIT's Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences for the Center of Brains, Minds, and Machines. When humans are exposed to a new concept, such as a new piece of kitchen equipment, a new dance move, or a new letter in an unfamiliar alphabet, they often need only a few examples to understand its makeup and recognize new instances. And while machines can now replicate some pattern recognition tests previously done by humans, I told you they were training some of the Google AI using YouTube videos for sight recognition. They were teaching it with YouTube videos. Machines typically need to be given hundreds or thousands of examples to perform with accuracy. It's been difficult to build machines that require little data like humans when learning a new concept, but replicating these abilities is an exciting area of research, connecting machine learning, statistics, computer vision. Uh-oh. So we had smell and taste. Now we have computer vision. Yes! And cognitive science. In the work appearing in Science This Week, which is a publication, researchers sought to shorten the learning process and make it more akin to the way humans acquire and apply knowledge. While judges' correct responses varied across the characters in these experiments, for each of the visual Turing tests, fewer than 25% of the judges performed significantly better than chance in assessing whether a machine or a human produced a given set of symbols. Before they get to kindergarten, children learn to recognize new concepts from just a single example and can even imagine new examples they haven't seen. We wanted to build models of these remarkable abilities, and we are still far from building machines as smart as a human child. But I thought just recently they had talked about a Turing test that they had done where it was able to respond as if it were like an 8-year-old child or something. But this is the first time we have had a machine able to learn and use a large class of real-world concepts, even simple visual concepts such as handwritten characters, in ways that are hard to tell it apart from humans. So there you go. Now, I don't know, this facial stuff and director stuff, there's all this AI stuff now that's going on with visual electronics, and I don't know. This is something that, well, maybe we'll end up the show here and tomorrow we can look at some of this other stuff. Now, we had found out on, I think it was Friday, maybe it was Thursday, how for the first time they are now touting that a virtual reality that they've created. I mean, we've gotten to the point with electronics and with CPU power that for the first time ever, they have been able to simulate reality in a VR setting where it is impossible to tell it apart. Now, that's pretty ludicrous. And as we've talked about the blending, the merging of reality and fantasy, and how for generations now we've been sucked into the machine from the television, starting with the radio, then the television, then video games, then 3D, then smart devices, your cell phones, your mobile devices, your tablets, now the goggles, I mean, it's not going to be too much longer. We talked about augmented reality. They're already discussing implants. We had the Google Glass. It's not going to be too much longer before that border that's already blurry, and we've kind of half crossed it, once we get to the other side and there's no going back. And then maybe it will be like the Matrix, where we're all plugged in a room in a real comfy chair somewhere. Got to make sure it's a massager chair, though, to keep that blood all flowing. And we're plugged into some alternate reality, and they're harvesting ATP out of our cells to fuel the factories. I don't know. I mean, I could definitely see that happening. Well, I saw a story yesterday. If I can get there quickly. Hold on 1 second. I think it was the last thing I posted last night before I finally went into a deep, dark sleep for 8 hours. Elon Musk, good old Elon Musk, launches a $1 billion. Now, it seems like $1 billion. I mean, the billionaires are just chucking $1 billion around here, there, and everywhere. It's like the third story within a couple weeks where we've seen big chunks of change, like $1 billion with a B, chucked around to work on artificial intelligence. Well, good old Elon Musk launches a $1 billion AI company, but this time the company is going to be to benefit humanity and to avoid robot wars. Now, if you can remember, Elon Musk was one of the tech titans that had come out not too long ago, within the last year or so, to say that we got to stop killer robots, to say that artificial intelligence is actually very dangerous and scary, and we need to put some brakes on what is currently happening, put some controls, get some ethics, step back and think about what the future is going to be if you develop this technology in an unbridled, uncontrolled fashion. Stephen Hawking, Wozniak, they all came out, Gates even. All right, so Elon Musk launches a $1 billion AI company to quote-unquote benefit humanity and avoid the robot wars. Tesla and SpaceX chief Elon Musk has already got a lot on his plate, but that hasn't stopped the ambitions of tech entrepreneur from starting up yet another open venture, and that is called OpenAI, a not-for-profit research company dedicated to advancing the science and ethics of artificial intelligence. Our goal is to advance digital intelligence in a way that is most likely to benefit humanity as a whole, he says, unconstrained by a need to generate financial return, which is wonderful. So they don't need to make a profit. They are not doing this to make money. They are doing it for reasons that will be clear, benefiting humanity, trying to save the future with $1 billion from Elon Musk, so they don't need to be funded in any other way. Since our research is free from financial obligations, we can better focus on a positive human impact. We believe that AI should be an extension of individual human wills and in the spirit of liberty, as broadly and evenly distributed as possible. And remember what we talked about as well, dollars precision medicine. And remember, this stuff isn't going to be cheap. Right now, they're offering it to the general public anytime you're sick, dead, or dying as a savior, because they need guinea pigs right now. They need to see what's going to happen 20 years down the line after they inject the shit into you and it morphs and mutates your cells. But once that's all over and we become the Isle of Dr. Moreau here, the whole big pot of Petri dish guinea pigs, it's no longer going to be for the common man. You know, they're going to have brain implants giving you superhuman capabilities for the rich kids. It's not going to be for your kid. We're going to be the inferior race. And one of the things they're talking about is being able to use AI as broadly and evenly distributed as possible as an extension of individual human will. So he wants to make sure that everybody has access to artificial intelligence, regardless of how rich or how poor you are. The company for which Musk will act as co-chairman is backed by another prominent Silicon Valley leader. And this is what scares me about this. I kind of like Elon Musk, but this guy, not so much. The other Silicon Valley leader is, PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel shows up in way too many things, as well as Netflix's Reed Hastings. And I haven't seen Reed show up in anything. This is kind of the first thing. OpenAI's goal is to help shape the future of potential AI. AI systems today have impressive but narrow capabilities, the founders say. It seems that we will keep whittling away at their constraints. And in the extreme case that they reach human performance on virtually every intellectual task, it is hard to fathom how much on a human level AI could benefit society today. And it is equally hard to imagine how much it could damage society if built or used incorrectly. Exactly what we've been saying from day one. The risks of unchecked AI are a topic of ongoing concern for Musk. And earlier in the year, and we talked about this, the petition to ban killer robots, Musk added his name to a coalition of more than 20,000 researchers and experts, including Stephen Hawking, Steve Wozniak, and Noam Chomsky. Gnome, calling for a ban on autonomous weapons that can fire on targets without human intervention due to the capabilities of AI systems. The key question for humanity today is whether to start a global AI arms race or to prevent it from ever starting. And if any major military power pushes ahead with AI weapons development, the U.S., DARPA, a global arms race is virtually inevitable. And the end point of this technological trajectory is obvious. Autonomous weapons will become the Kalashnikovs of tomorrow. OpenAI is not only concerned with the perils of killer robots, however, it is also designed to research AI in all kinds of different areas and get researchers to work on it. All right, guys, everybody stick around. It is Monday. Lonnie Clark is up next. Awesome radio all day, and I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everyone, take care.